I was originally going to say something about disasters, and I realized that, you know, but it's an interesting site for me, disasters, because it's far, you know, there's a way in which there's a lot of politicization that takes place in disasters. Some of you might have been here for an earthquake or been through something like that, and to me, it one of the things that comes about is a delegitimation of authority and the state, because usually the state fails miserably to take care of people in the most basic way. And this is exacerbated. This is more acute, of course, in the global south. And in fact, many revolutions have taken place shortly after disasters or mass mobilizations and politicizations have taken place. Mexico, 85, Iran, Nicaragua, a whole bunch of examples of the way in which certain fault lines are revealed. And I wanted to go back to something that John mentioned about cracks. Cracks in the system. I mean, usually the cracks aren't as obvious as when there's such a disaster. But I think it's important to remember that there are cracks everywhere. There are cracks, of course, that have been opened up by these upsurges that we've been talking about. But there's also cracks just that the system is fracturing under the weight of the constant day-to-day struggle. And that's a struggle not just of people, class struggle very broadly defined at the sites of reproduction and consumption and circulation as well as production, but also struggle with nature, to give some agency to nature, right? That ecological crisis is something that really we need to think of as not, you know, an entirely passive phenomena. And that this may, in fact, you know, this is a contradiction that capital faces, that clearly there's no resolution. It's a question of how it's going to end, how badly it's going to end. But so to think about this in terms of cracks, and I'm thinking also again of Ian's mentioning of the failed states, which are not the only ones that they're talking about. We have to remember then that this reminds us that the system is not as omnipotent as it sometimes seems. And so I think there's sometimes, and we all, I think, do this, when we make formulations about the state and capital as being in total control of everything at all times. And in fact, that's not the case. So I would just really like to end with that. And also, you know, that the state and capital are not external. I mean, it's not there's an external, you know, just as, and I you know, get this from John Holloway as well, that class struggle is not external. That is the working class or on one side and capital on the other. That they're in each other. I mean, that's the whole nature of the beast. And so there's a way in which these struggles take on very intimate forms as well. And it's important, and it's, I guess it's more clear with the sort of cyborg biopower kind of moment that we're in. And so that the freedom that so is paramount in the thoughts of anarchists. Takes place. One way to think of it is decommodification, you know, steady decommodification, and reclaiming of commons. Here again, where our slogans are becoming cliches, but there's truth to them, and to pay attention to these cracks and to not create in our own minds, you know, this own, you know, panoptic omnipotent state and capital. Because really, if you look around, they're having a lot of trouble even with biotech. That the project of commodifying the genome is not going according to plan so far. I mean, there's massive resistance to it, and that resistance is actually spreading up the commodity chain that is to previously established commodities, I think. So again, failed states, even the chief analyst of Morgan Stanley, he's always a bit of a pessimist. He said he predicts a Argentina-like crisis in the U.S. in 3 to 5 years. How are people, what resources, what reserves, culturally and otherwise, are people going to draw upon if, in fact, that were to take place? But, so just to leave, you know, and there's been so much wonderful history that I've learned so much from everything here, just to remember that there's a continuous, ongoing process and that we are not alone in at all.
Just want to sort of quickly address what the brother said about the biotech. Thank you. And what you were saying about sort of like what can we do to anarchize, I love that word. I'm going to steal it too. And if you want to get credit, you got to give me your name. So, but good.
Decommodified intellectual property.
Right. That's right. I think that there really is not really much mystery around that. I think that it just really comes down to people getting together and talking with people and sharing your ideas and coming up with shit to do and having it fail and trying something else. I don't want to sound glib about it, but I mean, I think that's the process. I mean, a few years ago, it used to be called organizing, but that's kind of controversial nowadays. So, but I think that's really, you know, all we can do. And, you know, you just, yeah. Thank you.
People put out some really interesting things. We've had a lot of conversations about, well, a lot of questions about tactics and means and ends. I guess one of the things that's most important for me when I look at, like, what cracks exist in the world, because I do think that, like, are these, like, identities or subjectivities or resistance are competing with the existing and rather boring things of, like, citizen and soldier and patriot and consumer. So it shouldn't be that hard to win, right? You just have to have, you know, creative identities that allow people to decide what they want to do with the rest of their lives. It is kind of appealing. On the other hand, like, we have to consider, like, well, what is it that is making those things kind of fall apart? And part of that is because people have a sense that when you're a citizen, you vote, and then things change when you want them to, and your opinion's kind of represented, and, you know, that, like, maybe when you're a consumer or producer, you go and you work, it's because you might not like how that economy is arranged, but it at least, like, makes sure that everyone's fed and they, you know, whatever. It's supposed to do all these things, and it's not, right? So those are really major cracks, like huge ones. Like the fact that, like, you know, not all Americans are safe forever is a huge crack for the U.S. Or like the fact that we don't really have a, like, efficient and reliable electoral system is a huge surprise for most people who live in the United States. Like, you might not know it if you took a survey of people in this room, but it is, right? So because of those things, I just think that this process of talking with people and saying that it matters, like, what people come to believe is a really important part of political activism. I think it's very easy for people who like to engage in radical tactics from time to time, like, is easy for us to forget, you know? Like, I think it's really important that we not forget it, that, like, we actually have to, like, have a conversation about not just whether the war sucks, but, like, whether it would be a good idea to withdraw, apologize, and pay reparations, right? Like, we have to put out the like, contrasting idea and convince people of it and talk to people of it rather than saying, like, well, what are the best tactics that we can have to impede the war? Because we need those people to make our tactics sustainable, right? Most really, really simple tactics, like standing in the street, right, are effective if 90% of the population does it, right? Whereas most, like, really, really effective tactics are not effective if 250 people do it in the country. So that's just, like, I don't know, to me, that's a huge part of means and ends, and it just belongs there. Other than that, I think that, you know, there are long-term questions of values. And I talked about this in the intro, but I think it's worth repeating. It's just, like, the non-visibility of people in the rest of the world and people of color in the U.S. to, like, a lot of people's moral radar screen is a huge problem. And, like, you know, I think that it speaks a lot to these, like, big issues around development and biotech and things like that. So we have to ask ourselves, does the existing system, like, provide, you know, reasonable health and security for most of the world? And they don't. And so I found myself at the Reclaim the Commons a year and a half ago being very, very, very alienated from the protests because they weren't talking about most of humanity. They weren't talking about 3 million people a year dying from malaria. They weren't on it, you know? And I think that, like, there's an enormous reserve of desire from people in the North to, like, care about the rest of the world because, like, we all wake up and we're all actually human, you know? And I think that, like, we have to have some faith in that. I'm really excited, though, that this afternoon we've tended to have, like, immensely more faith in, like, human beings in our conversation than we had this morning, and that makes me really happy.
One word that's gone around quite a lot is solidarity. I think we shouldn't think in terms of solidarity at all. I think we should think in terms of situational struggle. It's very much, I think, a Zapatista concept, but it's been formulated as well very explicitly by Colectivo Situaciones. Carol mentioned a while ago one of the Argentinian groups. The idea of situational struggle is that you should struggle where you are. No, There is an old video with an interview with Marcus, an Italian video, where at the end of the video he says to the interviewer, you know, we don't want your solidarity, thank you very much. You go and do your revolution to it in Italy. And when we've finished here, we'll come over and help you. And I think I feel very much the same. I mean, you do your revolution here in the United States, please. Another point that Ian, I think, mentioned, or I think referred to me, I think, as a catastrophist. I'm not. I don't feel I'm a catastrophist at all. But I do think that the way we think about revolution, the way we think about change, has changed, must change after Auschwitz and Hiroshima, must change now in the light of Bush, must change in the light of what scientists, many, many scientists, are saying about the possibility of humanity surviving another century. So certainly my position is not that there is going to be a catastrophe, but I do think we cannot assume that there is not going to be a catastrophe. And I like many of the things that Barry said this morning, but in one little aside, he said something about how historians would view us in 100 years' time. I simply don't think we can make that assumption. Maybe we will be here, or maybe our children, our grandchildren will be here in 100 years' time. But I don't think we can assume that. And I don't think we can take that as the basis for thinking about revolution. I really think it is a question of urgency now. And I think that that's in a way what's happening. That the world situation itself is changing the nature of time and changing the way that people think about time. The way the upsurge of struggle at the moment that is not oriented towards the state has a lot to do with time. A state-centered approach tells you, wait until we take power, wait until we win the next election, and then things will change. And more people are saying, no, we can't wait. We can't wait. We want to do things now. We must do things now. And they're saying that because of their own objective situation. Literally, they cannot wait. And I think that that also changes radically the relation between those. We had the question there, sorry, he's gone now, but at least I don't know if he's gone, but, oh yes, there you are, about communism and anarchism. I think the question of the distinction between communism and anarchism has a lot to do with time, or the old distinction. No? Certainly the orthodox Marxist view was, wait until we take power, and then we will transform things, you know. The anarchist position, I think, was more that we need to transform things now. I think more and more what people are saying is, no, we cannot wait. Our point of reference in the struggles is not the taking of power in the future. Our only point of reference is the present transformation of social relations. How, within this horrible capitalist society, can we create different types of social relations? And I think before I mentioned a whole series of things that the new movements are talking about, one thing I forgot to mention is precisely that. One thing they're talking about explicitly an awful lot is love. Now, how can we actually create now a transformation of social relations? I was reading one interview with somebody in one of the Argentinian groups who's saying, well, what we need to do is talk about amorosidad, no? Amorosity, or loviness, I suppose. You know, and that when you're in these hardcore poor districts of Buenos Aires, where people, you know, men rather, have to live as hard men, you know, as hard macho men, or have traditionally done so, then to come and talk about amorosidad or loveliness, you know, seems absolute nonsense. But that's really what's happening, and that's really what it's all about. Okay, so the problem is I think, a question of time. How do we create the not yet in the present? which has a lot to do with the question we had over there about what do you replace capitalist society with. It's not a future question of what will we replace capitalist society with. What are the different social relations that people are already creating? That as well has to do with Chris's question about unrecuperable tactics. And I think my first reaction was in a way what you were saying. I think we can't think about unrecuperable tactics in the sense of a model. There's no answer there at all. There's no answer. The only answer is a constant question, a constant experimenting. But perhaps there is something unrecuperable, and the unrecuperable is actually the moment of rebellion. No. And as well, if you read what people are saying about, say, the war of water in Cochabamba in 2000, what they're saying is, yes, this experience was so intense that that's unrecuperable. That's something we can't lose. In other words, if you want to talk about unrecuperable tactics, you have to think about the moment, but not about some model that we can learn and apply to different situations, which finally has to do with the question of fetishism, you know, that Eddie asked me to talk about. I think one way of seeing the question of fetishism is really in terms of nouns and verbs. That the process of defetishizing is actually a process of criticizing nouns, of understanding the world in terms of verbs. You know, that a self-determining society wouldn't be a society of nouns, it would be a society of verbs. A society in which we would understand things in terms of our doing. We would decide things would be decided not in terms of stable structures or congealed actions, not in terms of institutions, but in terms of absolute self-determination. Now, I think that means, in fact, a society of an intensity of human feeling, an intensity of social relations that we cannot even imagine at the moment. But I think that is what we're talking about, actually. That is where we have to go. And I think that means kind of all the time trying to push theory beyond our own limits. You know, that we can't go back for our theory. We have to go forward. We have to create, not just for our theory, for our practice as well. We have to be creating, experimenting, and going beyond limits all the time. Thanks.
I want to thank you all, and I really enjoyed the afternoon session. I was hoping that all of us could be here to make a kind of closure anyway. But I did want to respond to Chris Carlson's question about exclusion. And I don't think that's really the right word for it, but I can say that we really need to get ourselves together in terms of understanding this is very serious business, you know, that if we really are serious and want to change things, not that we can't laugh and have a good time, but that the kind of lack of organization, and I don't mean structure and hierarchy, but where there's responsibilities expected and taken, then I think we do attract a lot of people who aren't prepared to really contribute, and it is a big drain, and this is pretty much what killed the 1960s movement, I think, eventually, is people, but what happened was most of us went into closed groups then and decided, you know, how can we organize, and I can tell you that's not the right way to do it. So I think we need to do it as we go along. And I think we're capable of it. And as far as hopeful, I mean, I'm extremely hopeful, because what else is there? You know, if you're not optimistic, why would you even be doing this if you didn't have any hope that that humanity can triumph? It's a lifetime commitment and a lifetime culture. You don't have to win in your lifetime. You keep going. It is the only way to live. So therefore, it's hopeful because it's life. And I guess that's how I would close.
Well, no. I mean, one of the things about 68, and Danny LaRouge was right. We used to, those of us flying, as I say, under the black flag, used to, were very harsh about Danny. But he did say later, you know, if you lived through those days, and you were in the much larger meeting rooms than this, there were thousands of people, and there was serious things at stake. The point was, we were deliberating what to do. And it feels kind of an abstraction here today, and that's not our fault in a way, I think. A lot of these questions are great questions. They've just gone into the air. I mean, there's a certain feeling of waiting. For what? I don't know. I just want to make a couple of remarks to end with. I felt all day that the kind of the pressure of the, certainly the kind of the objectification that somehow we have to decide what to do about them. I certainly share that sentiment. I worry about the linguistic straitjacket of anarchy, anarchist. My own identifications, because I'm a historian and I work quite a lot in the 17th century, I would identify myself as a leveler. I think that's a great old term from the English Revolution. The Irish used it against the English. I'm a leveler. That seems good. Antinomian was another. I've done quite a lot of work on the Muggletonians, a small sect, very small sect, at most a few hundred people, the last of whom died in the 1970s. There are some strange characters who when you trawl the archives, come up like sort of, you know, coelacanths from the deep ocean. But okay, so what... I'm still mulling over... So good question. What does an anarchist physics look like? I didn't have a good reply, really, because we don't really... In a way, we don't know. What does anarchist knowledge look like? Well, it wouldn't necessarily be anarchist. It would be, you know... Ruth Hubbard would say, what would a feminist medicine look like? Well, it would know a fuck of a lot more about... Cardiologists would know more about women's heart attacks, to use the, you know, completely banal example. An anarchist physics might refuse fusion on the grounds that you don't want that kind of massive gradients and hierarchy between the magma and 3 inches away in the outside world. But taking John's point, a lot of it would be negation, absolute negation. No to plutonium. Plutonium should not exist in nature. Barry Commoner might have been right. No to vinyl compounds. What is this thing about rocket science? Rocket science is relatively trivial. 4 degrees of freedom will get you to the moon and back. It's more projectile ballistics. It's not that difficult. To understand rocketeering is trivial compared to understanding, you know, 1 square meter of lawn, which God knows is nearly a monoculture. So an anarchist biology would say no to the gene, the fetishization of the gene. Why is Ignacio Chapella resisting? Why is he in the crosshairs? He's done a couple of things, right? He resisted the privatization of the University of California with respect to research. But he did another thing. He came from Mexico. He's a Basque Mexican. And it's not because he's an anarchist, but actually his biology is the reverse of bourgeois biology, which fetishizes the gene. What is biotech about? It's about actually with very small golden bomblets with sticky DNA on, actually firing these things into the nucleus so that you can put proprietary markers on them. It's a biology that's dedicated to the line, to inheritance, very unlike the sociality of knowledge production that's produced by those who are saving the seeds, the traditional people, so-called, of the earth. An anarchist horticulture, I learned from my neighbor that I didn't have a snail surplus. I had a duck deficit. This is anarchist horticulture. You don't call it anarchist, it's just the right way to look after, to do gardening. I was associated when young with the radical science movement. And Chris Carlson just mentioned to me, whispered in my ear, the labor process, that's right. A leveling antinomian science. And I use science here, I want to try and recover it from this, you know, science. Actually existing science, as I say, is capital's way of knowing the world, but actually a radically democratic knowledge-making, and I think that's what the university should be about, that we could all think of ourselves as makers of knowledge, of new knowledge, right, to make up for the staggering forgetting that's happened. The radical science movement in Britain, it was not just about historians of science or sociologists, it included working scientists. The idea was you'd have, you know, rotation of tasks, no division of labor, it would be an artisanal thing, and the questions would be being asked by those who were doing the science themselves. Citizen scientists. I mean, that's a statist way to put it. That's what that was Barry Commoner's vision. I don't like citizen, but we know where he's going with that. Just a couple of other words. I very much like what what Carvel said about non-routinizing. We haven't spent too much time on the violence question. One thing that's still haunting me is that very famous, some of you may know about it, a very famous debate from long ago on Dutch television between Chomsky and Foucault. Chomsky said he'd never met such an amoral man as Michel Foucault. Again, Chomsky revealed himself to be the Enlightenment rationalist who was appalled by Foucault's invocation of rough justice. And I just think that's the right position to take on the question of violence. The violence routinized, we quickly become the mirror of the state. But who can say what happens at insurrectionary moments? It may come soon. For me, the real question of why afflicted powers, I hope, will generate some discussion is how on earth we can, how we face the fact that we're up against a very powerful movement of vanguardist opposition to modernity in the Islamic world. And then, finally, I just want to say that we're going to have a lot more meetings like this to work through these questions. And I'm sorry, as I didn't mean to say that all the oxygen had left the room, because I want to say that it's been a great pleasure for me to be here, actually, today. I was anxious about it. I came, and I've learned an awful lot from Roxanne when she opened things. And I thank the cluster again, and I thank Barry and Eddie and co., And all of you for staying so late. I just want to say that I always reach in my backpack at the end, trying to finish things off, for the great poets of revolution. And let us not forget that in the forefront of the crowd that tore open the gates of the English carceral state in the late 18th century was a young poet and printer. He designed money for the English state, and he was an antinomian and a leveler. And he taught, he was in the front row of those who opened Tyburn Prison, the English Bastille. And his name was William Blake. And he once said, maybe there will be times soon when we will be in rooms like this, and we will not feel the energy go out of the room, because, as William Blake said, the tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction. Thank you.